The Trumpet Daily Program begins right now.
Today's world news, what it means, where it's taking us.
I bring you the one and only possible message of world peace.
This is a message of hope, tremendous hope. And he said unto me, you must prophesy again.
And now, The Trumpet Daily with Stephen Flurry.
Hello again, everyone, and welcome back to the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. It's already Friday, can you believe it? A full week of broadcasting nearly complete here on KPCG and KPCG.fm if you're listening to the live stream that goes all around the world. We have a lot to get to on today's program, including a conversation with our very own Richard Palmer. We're going to be discussing in the next segment the royal wedding that's going on this weekend here in the UK, Prince Harry and Meghan Markle. So that's coming up tomorrow, and Richard will have some interesting thoughts on that wedding, particularly as it compares to the one that happened in 2011. Well, given what we've been discussing in recent weeks, my father's new Key of David program is a definite must-see this weekend. It's about Iran. Well, I guess more specifically, it's about the little nation of Jordan. But as you know, with that particular region, Iran has been expanding its influence and power in recent years. It's definitely the most dominant power in the Middle East. It's infiltrated Iraq. It's spread its influence into Syria and Lebanon and Yemen. The Bible prophesies that eventually it's going to expand that influence into Egypt and Libya. But one little nation right in that very neighborhood that's not going to fall into the hands of that prophesied king of the south is the little nation of Jordan. How is that possible? Well, the Bible prophesies of this, and my father goes into that on his program this weekend. So make sure that you tune in to his latest Key of David program to understand why the nation of Jordan escapes this growing influence of the King of the South. He says on the program, by the way, that you need to prove it because all this is leading to some of the most momentous events that you've ever seen in your life. Bible prophecy being fulfilled. The title of the show this weekend, Jordan and God's Church in Prophecy. I might also mention the latest on our literature, a couple of new booklets. One in particular, you might have seen it referenced in last night's trumpet brief from Joel Hilliker. He said early on in that brief that he said, I realize that this is outside our usual offerings, but then he goes on to recommend this new book, How to Pray. And I got an email from him late last night, my time, and he said that he had gotten 186 requests for the book. So this is that's just from the trumpet brief. That's just from the trumpet brief after it went out for a few hours. So there's no telling how many more requests there will be this morning when he gets into the Edmund office there. But that's tremendous, that kind of interest in a book that significant, in a book that important. And we've been waiting for that book to be printed on this end as well, because we're anxious to get into the subject of prayer on television here in the UK. In fact, that program, I believe it was Wednesday, the Bible study for Wednesday's show, where we talked about the importance of prayer. We're hoping to convert that material into a television production as well, and offer this new book, How to Pray, a number of chapters, I think 7 chapters in that book. And by the way, you can get to that book even now at the trumpet.com website. If you're anxious to get into the material, you can begin studying the PDF today if you want to get a head start on the actual print copy of How to Pray. Well, here in the opening segment, I just want to follow up on yesterday's show where we talked about that New York Times story that came out Wednesday night, and then it was featured at the top of the fold on the front page in yesterday's print edition. Codename Crossfire Hurricane, the secret origins of the Trump investigation. And so here is this expose based upon all of these leaks. The leaks continue. And we went through a fair bit of that material yesterday. There's quite a few other conservative commentators that have weighed in on that New York Times piece, individuals that are a fair bit smarter than we are here at the Trumpet Daily Radio Show, particularly with respect to investigations and legal matters and such. And so we'll go through some of the most, some of the points that really stood out to us the most following what we talked about yesterday. But before I get to that, let me just again remind you of what my father said in that Saving America article from the most recent Trumpet magazine, where he talked about how that the whole Trump-Russia investigation is based on a hoax. It's based on a hoax. And here they've been searching, Mueller's team. Yesterday was the one-year anniversary, by the way. And they've been searching and searching and searching for evidence of collusion for almost 2 years. My father says a year and a half, a full year as far as the special counsel goes. And nothing, nothing's turned up. In fact, that was brought out in the New York Times piece. That we still have not found anything. There's still no evidence. The New York Times says a year and a half later, no public evidence has surfaced connecting Mr. Trump's advisors to the hacking or linking Mr. Trump himself to the Russian government's disruptive efforts. Nothing. No evidence. Nothing has surfaced. And believe me, they have looked. But like my father said, it's based on a hoax, and really what it's revealing is not Russian collusion with the Trump campaign or vice versa. What it's revealing is the tremendous amount of lawbreaking by bureaucrats in intelligence and law enforcement. He talked about how President Obama just filled those agencies with treasonous agents. And that's what President Trump called Peter Strzok back in January, for saying what he said in a text message about an insurance policy. We need it. We need this investigation. We need it like insurance. And there are liberals that have come forward and said, well, he didn't really mean anything by that. I mean, it's just a figure of speech. Well, what is insurance? What is insurance intended to do? It's intended to restore something to what it was previously, before the damage happened. In this case, Donald Trump, he's the damage. And so how are we going to fix it after the fact? We need insurance. All kinds of corruption. Abuses of power. Molly Hemingway at The Federalist, she had a number of takeaways from the New York Times story. The big bombshell, the way she sees it, is that the FBI has now admitted, yeah, we spied on the Trump campaign. We did spy. Remember how they went after Mark Levin and a few others over a year ago when he said, hang on a second, they're spying. They're spying. We could put together a pretty long montage about all the ridicule that he faced and a few others too. It wasn't just him. But they were spying, and now here we are a little over a year later, and it's just kind of casually mentioned in the New York Times piece. The New York Times, it says, this is from that Wednesday article, the FBI investigated four unidentified Trump campaign aides in those early months. Congressional investigators revealed in February the four men were Michael Flynn, Paul Manafort, Carter Page, and George Papadopoulos. Current and former officials said. It says the FBI obtained phone records and other documents using national security letters, a secret type of subpoena, officials said, and at least one government informant met several times with Mr. Page and Mr. Papadopoulos, current and former officials said. So they had a plant, as you've been hearing over the last week and a half. They had a spy. They had a spy. They were tapping into phones. They were wiretapping Trump Tower. And as Molly Hemingway brings out at the Federalist, I mean, this is just a stunning admission. A stunning admission. This abuse of power, these intelligence agencies using their powers to surveil the Trump campaign. And the most amazing aspect of this, as she quotes, quoting from another source, is just how blasé the Times is about this revelation, the Obama administration actively spying on at least four individuals in those early months before the presidential election. Wiretaps, national security letters, as she says. Quoting the New York Times, at least one spy, some have said two. The FBI, the Times wrote, obtained phone records and other documents using national security letters, a secret type of subpoena. I read part of this a moment ago. At least one government informant met several times with Page and Papadopoulos. That has become a politically contentious point, with Mr. Trump's allies questioning whether the FBI was spying on the Trump campaign or trying to entrap campaign officials. Well, I should say it's become a contentious point because they were spying. And now evidence is beginning to roll out suggesting that this was entrapment. This was a setup from the beginning. We'll come to that more in just a second. But here we are, no evidence of collusion after almost 2 years and an investigation now for the past year that's had unlimited resources and nothing has turned up. And so some, like Devin Nunez, are rightfully asking, what was the justification for starting this counterintelligence investigation in the first place? If there was no criminal activity, why start in on the spying? Let's switch over to Andy McCarthy. This is at National Review. It says, you have to dig pretty deep to find that the FBI ran at least one government informant against the Trump campaign. That's dig deep in the New York Times article, something like almost 4,000 words. And to note that the Times learned this because current and former officials leaked to reporters the same classified information about which just days ago the Justice Department shrieked extortion when Congress asked about it. You remember that, Rod Rosenstein? He cried extortion. We're not going to be extorted just because Congress wants this information. We can't give it out. It's too sensitive. It would endanger lives. And here are the officials themselves, these anonymous sources. They go ahead and leak the information. And then the New York Times is happy to lap it up and make it public for everyone to see. And meanwhile, the DOJ and the FBI continue to stonewall when Congress comes knocking and says, hey, can you give us the information? Can we look at it? Can we see how this investigation is being operated? McCarthy goes on to say, but that's not even the most important of the buried leads. What the Times story makes explicit, with studious understatement, is that the Obama administration used its counterintelligence powers to investigate the opposition party's presidential campaign. That's right there in the article. The Times posted just Wednesday night. They used counterintelligence powers. They used the powers that the DOJ and the NSA and the CIA and the FBI had to spy on a political opponent. McCarthy says that is there was no criminal predicate to justify an investigation of any Trump campaign official. So the FBI did not open a criminal investigation. Instead, the Bureau opened a counterintelligence investigation and hoped that evidence of crimes committed by Trump officials would emerge. How dangerous is this direction for the United States? Well, it's been temporarily halted. As we now know, there's a temporary resurgence in the United States, thanks to a Jeroboam type, because of God's mercy, because God has pity on us. It says, but going back to what was happening, though, before Mr. Trump was elected, but it is an abuse of power to use counterintelligence powers, including spying and electronic surveillance, to conduct what is actually a criminal investigation. That is an abuse of power of the highest order. McCarthy says the Times barely mentions the word counterintelligence in its saga. That's not an accident. The paper is crafting the media Democrat narrative. Here is how things are to be spun. And what McCarthy's getting at here is they're basically preempting the Inspector General's report. That's supposed to come out this month. And evidently they're going to be hammered, these intelligence institutions. And so here comes the New York Times after all of these leaks. I went through that yesterday, something like 12 of them. Former and current officials, even ones that are there right now, they're leaking away. Just like Comey did. Just like Clapper did. Just like Brennan has done. The FBI, here is how things are to be spun. Now, we went through some of this yesterday, but listen to this. Here's the spin. The FBI was very public about the Clinton emails investigation, even making disclosures about it on the eve of the election, yet it kept the Trump-Russia investigation tightly under wraps, despite intelligence showing that the Kremlin was sabotaging the election for Trump's benefit. This effectively destroyed Clinton's candidacy and handed the presidency to Trump. See, that's what the New York Times said. That, look, we could have been a lot harder on President Trump. He's lucky that we kept it quiet, that we kept it secret. This is the spin. And here is McCarthy straightening it out. He says, just because the two FBI cases are both referred to as investigations does not make them the same kind of thing. The Clinton case was a criminal investigation that was predicated on a mountain of incriminating evidence. She had the email servers. She was deleting emails by the tens of thousands saying they were about yoga. Her aides were in on it. They were scrubbing servers. They were destroying hardware. That's some tangible evidence with which investigators can work with. So here he is outlining the difference between these two investigations. McCarthy says, now Mrs. Clinton does have one legitimate beef against the FBI. Then Director James Comey went public with some, but by no means all of the proof against her. It is not proper for law enforcement officials to publicize evidence from a criminal investigation unless formal charges are brought. But you'll recall what happened. He came forward with the public press conference and said that she was careless, but she's not a criminal. We recommend no charges. McCarthy says, in the scheme of things, though, this was a minor infraction. The scandal here, listen to this, the scandal here is that Mrs. Clinton was not charged. She likes to blame Comey for her defeat, but she had a chance to win only because the Obama Justice Department and the FBI tanked the case against her in exactly the manner President Obama encouraged them to do in public commentary. Remember that? The interview with Chris Wallace, I think it was March or something of 2016. He said what Comey would say a few months later. You know, she was careless, but her heart was right. No criminal intent. Obama set the stage for all of those departments, tanking that investigation. They were his subordinates. He was in charge. He was the president. Brennan worked for him. Comey worked for him. Clapper worked for him. And if he gets on national TV and says she was careless, but she didn't have any criminal activity in all of this, they took it and ran with it. Comey started to pen the exoneration letter even before the interview that she had with the FBI. And of course, it wasn't to be under oath. I mean, she was carefully protected all the way through. She was to be the successor. She was the anointed one. McCarthy goes on and says here, by contrast, the Trump case is a counterintelligence investigation. Unlike criminal cases, counterintelligence matters are classified. If agents had made public disclosures about them, they would have been committing crimes and violating solemn agreements with foreign intelligence services, agreements without which those services would not share information that U.S. national security officials need in order to protect our country. So here he is highlighting the differences, the vast differences in these two investigations. The Times comes out on Wednesday and makes them sound like they're essentially the same. And that, well, we actually did Trump a favor by keeping it secret. Whereas with Clinton, it was more public, or at least some of the details. McCarthy says, in the scheme of things, though, the problem is not that the FBI honored its confidentiality obligations in the Trump case while violating them in the Clinton case. The scandal is that the FBI, lacking the incriminating evidence needed to justify opening a criminal investigation of the Trump campaign, decided to open a counterintelligence investigation. And it says here, with the blessing of the Obama White House, they took the powers that enable our government to spy on foreign adversaries and use them to spy on Americans. Americans who just happen to be their political adversaries. This is devastating. This piece by McCarthy at National Review. Just devastating. He says the Times averts its eyes from this point, although if a Republican administration tried this sort of thing on a Democrat candidate, it would be the only point. This would be the only point of focus. Now, McCarthy goes on to explain that the liberals, the radical leftists, they try to muddy the waters by saying, well, it was a counterintelligence investigation into Russia. But it wasn't. They were spying on Carter Page, Papadopoulos, Manafort, Mike Flynn. These were all members of the Trump campaign. But see, they want to say, well, it was Russian collusion, so we had to investigate this to see if they weren't concerned, remember, about any of that Russian meddling in the election before the actual election, because they thought Hillary would win. And so they were made aware of it, their meddling. And you'll recall Susan Rice telling the counter, whatever it is, cybersecurity official in the White House to stand down. Don't fight back against the Russians. Don't get ahead of President Obama on this. President Obama downplayed it. He wanted to make sure that it wasn't a big story because he thought Hillary would win, and he didn't want to give any kind of excuse to the Trump people that, well, she only won because of the Russians. Then Donald Trump wins, and they promptly turn the tables and say, oh, he won because of Russian collusion. Kimberly Strassel at the Wall Street Journal, she asked this morning, was this whole investigation into Donald Trump and his campaign, was it just a setup from the beginning? And she refers to the New York Times article again about these government officials acknowledging that the Bureau was using a human informant, a spy, to communicate with Carter Page and George Papadopoulos. I mean, how do we know it wasn't just a setup? This meeting between Papadopoulos and the Australian ambassador, or at least the information that Papadopoulos received, that supposedly Russia had some of Hillary Clinton's emails. That ambassador, by the way, from Australia, I mean, he was a big Hillary Clinton supporter. How many people are involved in this? Strassel says in her piece, the Times slipped this mind-bending fact into the middle of an otherwise glowing profile of the noble Bureau and dismissed it as no big deal. Oh, yeah, we had some spies in the Trump campaign. But boy, the FBI sure did Mr. Trump a lot of favors. Can you believe this? And the truth is now trickling out. And it's about to probably be an avalanche of truth when that Inspector General's report comes out later this month. Strassel refers to a few comments that Devin Nunez made on Fox and Friends. I believe this is from Tuesday morning. Here's clip one.
If there was a spy, though, what does that mean for Fusion GPS?
Well,
or for Christopher Steele?
Well, I think what it really means, I think it will look badly on the Department of Justice and the FBI on how they conducted this investigation.
Right.
That's what we're trying to get to the bottom of. We're trying to put clarity and sunlight for the American people so they know everything that happened on how this investigation began.
So he's doggedly searching for the truth. And he's getting closer and closer to it, which is why the Times comes out with that piece to put the radical leftist spin on it first, to give them the opportunity to get their message, their narrative out there. Here's what was happening. Here's what was going on. Yeah, we admit this and this. They just say it casually, and then they carry on. But notice here what Mr. Nunez said, again, in that Fox and Friends interview. Here's clip two.
I think if the campaign was somehow set up, I think that would be a problem. Right. If there were somehow meetings that occurred and all this was a setup, because we have yet to see any credible evidence or intelligence right. that led to the opening of this investigation.
By you saying that, it makes it sound like you believe Donald Trump was framed.
Well, look, I believe that they didn't have that. Well, first of all, I believe they never should have opened a counterintelligence investigation into a political party. Counterintelligence investigations are very rarely do they happen, and when they do happen,
right.
you have to be very careful because you're using the tools of our intelligence services mm-hmm. and relationships with other countries in order to spy on a political campaign. Probably not a good idea.
Okay, a little bit of an understatement. Not a good idea to use the intelligence agencies as a weapon to set up a potential president of the United States, that would be a problem. This is more than a problem. I mean, this is undermining the institutions on which the United States is built. It's like the Spectator noted here. Make no mistake about it. The FBI and the CIA, on little more than the say-so of a virulent Trump hater like Brennan, they were meeting to spy on the campaign of Hillary's opponent, and it makes Watergate look like a 10th-rate burglary. That's how serious this is. What an abuse of power. It's exactly as my father said in that Saving America piece. Nothing on Russian collusion. All that's a big hoax. But a tremendous amount of lawbreaking going on at the FBI, in the DOJ. That Spectator piece, by the way, it quotes the New York Times. Here's another bombshell. The FBI's thinking crystallized by mid-August after CIA director at the time, John Brennan, shared intelligence with Comey. That's two intelligence agencies. They're sharing intelligence, showing that the Russian government was behind an attack on the 2016 presidential election. Intelligence agencies, plural, began collaborating to investigate that operation. The Crossfire Hurricane team was part of that group, but largely operated independently, three officials said. As the Spectator brings out, contained in that oh-so-nonchalant line, intelligence agencies, plural, began collaborating, working together to investigate that operation. And then you think about the Obama administration working furiously in those, even in the last days of his presidency, to empower those agencies so that they could spread that information from agency to agency and keep going after Trump, even while he's president. This is what was happening. The Spectator says, for all intents and purposes, Crossfire Hurricane did not begin in July 2016, but at the moment Trump emerged as Hillary's rival, Brennan, shortly thereafter, was bringing CIA agents, FBI agents, NSA agents, and an assortment of Obama's political aides together in one room at CIA headquarters to bat around ideas on how to smoke out the campaign of Hillary's opponent. Out of these meetings came the plot to infiltrate the Trump campaign. See, the details are emerging of what was really happening in that last year during the Obama administration. You think about the United States of America. Its government exists solely to maintain a nation's rule of law. But America is now a place where the government's almost dominated by a deep state of spies and agents, politicians and bureaucrats who are spying on voters and their representatives and who are colluding. They're colluding to advance their own ideologies, their own personal gain. Here's the government taking the powers allotted to it by the Constitution and using those powers to destroy the Constitution, to destroy the rule of law. And when you consider the size of government today and the far-reaching impact of these abuses of power, really, I mean, we know why it didn't happen. But just looking at it on the surface, it's amazing that the radical left failed to install Hillary Clinton into power and to effectively complete this takeover. So it's incredible that Donald Trump was elected. It's amazing that his presidency has endured so many direct assaults by politicians, journalists, commentators, and of course, especially the bureaucrats inside the executive branch, of which he's supposed to be the constitutional leader. Donald Trump presides over the DOJ now. I mean, it was Obama, now it's Trump. He presides over the FBI. But going back to before he was inaugurated, you think about the power that these individuals, these players had, Barack Obama and all of his aides, Hillary Clinton, the anointed successor, Brennan, Clapper, Comey. It's amazing that Donald Trump was able to win the presidency and to revive some of America's, at least physical, greatness. How did this happen? Well, as my father wrote in Saving America from the Radical Left Temporarily, he said that God intervened to save the United States temporarily, not because of Mr. Trump's greatness, but because of God's pity. You can read about that in 2 Kings 14. Here's a clip from that program last weekend, God Saves Israel Temporarily. I played this earlier in the week, I believe, clip 3.
Well, you have the history of Israel, and then it is prophetic when God talks about saving Israel. He saved them anciently, for temporarily, and he's going to save them in this end time, temporarily. So he can get one more message to them, one more warning. He's given numerous warnings before, but he wants to give one more to give them a chance to repent and turn to God and not be corrected as severely as they will be if they don't respond.
What a merciful God we worship. Now again, President Trump, he's a man that has some flaws, as my father says in that article. But look at what's happened here. My father wrote, "The radical left is relentlessly waging war against the president and leading this country to its destruction. We're witnessing a government and a nation on the verge of collapse." Think about how close America was to that happening following the previous election, the last election. We've mentioned this before, what Herbert Armstrong said back in the 1950s about this radical left-wing communist ideology that was infiltrating the nation even back in the 50s. This is going back 60, 70 years ago. Mr. Armstrong said it's a kind of warfare that we don't understand or know how to cope with. It uses every diabolical means to weaken us from within, sapping our strength, perverting our morals, sabotaging our educational system, wrecking our social structure, destroying our spiritual and religious life, weakening our industrial and economic power, demoralizing our armed forces, he says, and finally, after such infiltration, overthrowing our government by force and violence. You look back over the last 60 or 70 years and ask yourself, has that happened? Look at what we're seeing take place. Look at what we're seeing in the inner workings of U.S. government. I mean, we're entering into the very last stage of that progression that he described there in 1956. As my father said in Great Again, the communists aim to destroy the system, but because they can't build another one until that happens. He said, the communist attack from within America is far more significant than you may realize. We're staring it in the face today. We must see reality. Something deadly dangerous has seized the country, far more than what people realize. He says there's a spiritual dimension to what is happening, and you cannot understand these events unless you recognize this. Of course, he's talking about the influence of Satan the devil. And yet, look at the mercy of God and the temporary resurgence that we're seeing, because God is giving us another opportunity, one last opportunity, to turn to him in repentance. Here's one final clip from that Key of David program last weekend, clip 4.
But there is a Jeroboam type in this end time, and God said he would use him to save Israel temporarily. Temporarily, just like it happened in ancient Israel. And it's there in the book of Kings, and I'll show you. And that segment is prophetic, as is all of that history in the book of Kings and those other former prophets. But it could be more than temporary. It could be permanent if the people would listen to this final message that God has for them, this final warning, because there are problems in Israel that must be solved, and God has certainly some warning for all of them.
You see, as frightening as it is to see all of this evil spread like cancer, it's very encouraging, very hopeful to see our God reaching out to his people, sending this message, giving us hope, showing us that there is safety in him, in his work. I mentioned the latest program that's due to play this weekend about Jordan in prophecy. Here's this little nation just surrounded by enemies, surrounded by all of these powerful and evil enemies. And yet look at what God is able to do with a seemingly helpless little nation. If it'll just turn or look to God, well, really the intervention there has more to do with what God intends to do with his people, his work. God's purpose stands. God's purpose will be fulfilled. I mean, we are right at the heart of what's happening in this world, whether you realize it or not. What you're hearing on this program, what you're seeing at thetrumpet.com or reading in our new booklets, this is what's uppermost in God's mind. And as I've been saying, well, particularly last week, now more than ever, we need to be pouring our heart, our energies, our time, our effort, our prayers into supporting this great work of God, this final work, this final time that our people will be measured, as it says there in Amos chapter 7. When we come back, we'll be speaking with TheTrumpet.com's Richard Palmer about the wedding, the royal wedding that will happen at Windsor Castle tomorrow. It's already upon us. We'll have some interesting things to say about this one as it compares to the previous one from 2011. You're listening to Stephen Fleury, and this is the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. If you'd like to email the program, you can send comments to td@kpcg.fm. We'll be right back.
This is KPCG-FM, and this is the Trumpet Daily. Is prophecy real? Is it anything more than a collection of imaginations, vagaries, and wishful thinking? The answer is no. Human beings have never dreamed up an authentic prediction of the future. The human mind simply isn't capable of it. Such a feat would require godlike power. What about Bible prophecy? Is Bible prophecy real? Is it different than the litany of other failed prophecies that have been discarded throughout human history? Unlike other books, particularly those books that claim to predict the future, the Bible has endured for thousands of years. Something about this book has transcended thousands of generations of human history. And this book, the Holy Bible, claims to predict the future. It claims its prophecies come not from the minds of human beings, but from the mind of their Creator, from the mind of God. Prove the Bible's prophecies for yourself. If you cannot honestly prove them to be true, discard the Bible and move on with your life. But if you can, what a spectacular book the Bible becomes. Request Herbert W. Armstrong's free book, The United States and Britain in Prophecy. This book will examine the core Bible prophecies and compare them to history and current events. More than 6 million people have requested this amazing and easy-to-read book. Order The United States and Britain in Prophecy by Herbert W. Armstrong and prove Bible prophecy for yourself. Email your request to td@kpcg.fm or visit thetrumpet.com. The Trumpet Daily Radio Show airs every morning at 7 a.m. Central Time on KPCG 101.3 FM in Edmond, Oklahoma.
So Prince Harry and Meghan Markle are getting married this weekend. The newest or the latest royal wedding is tomorrow at St. George's Chapel on the grounds of Windsor Castle. And it's interesting, as I said earlier, that if you compare it to 2011, when Prince William and Kate Middleton were married, at that wedding, or concerning that wedding, 2 billion people watched around the world. But this time around, I mean, it is getting a little bit of news now, but as I said before the break, I didn't really pay much attention to it in recent weeks or months. But this story did catch our attention earlier this week, because it's about how Britain is far less interested in this particular royal wedding. This new poll has found that 2 in 3 Brits have minimal interest in the royal wedding. The Independent has this to say: in a sign of possible public indifference to the royal wedding, far fewer street parties are being held to celebrate Prince Harry and Meghan Markle's wedding than were staged for the marriage of Prince William and Kate Middleton. It says here, listen to these figures: judging by the number of road closure applications received by the county council, Kent is holding 14 street parties compared to 182 in 2011, a drop of 92%. And then it says further, in 2011, the local government association used road closure numbers to estimate that more than 5,500 street parties were held for the Prince William Kate Middleton wedding. I guess this is nationwide. The other one was in Kent. But it says, but the known drops in street party numbers leaves little doubt that the nationwide total will be way below 5,500 recorded in 2011, which itself was comfortably below the estimated figures for the Queen's 1977 Silver Jubilee and the 1981 wedding of Prince Charles and Diana. So you see the trajectory as it goes downward And we have Richard Palmer in the studio here with us, who happens to be British.
Yes.
And has lived here for the better part of his life. He was over at AC, of course, for a few years in Jerusalem. Anywhere else? You've lived an exotic life, Richard.
Just those two, I think.
Okay.
But you got a few months in Africa as a kid, but...
Okay. But you were here in 2011.
Right.
For the previous royal wedding, Prince William and Kate Middleton. So how, I guess, based upon your, not just your personal experience, but also with what, since you're so heavy into the news, with what you've read, I mean, what are some of the key differences that you see this time around with this royal wedding as compared to the last one?
Yeah, it definitely is a lot lower key. The other major royal event that we had recently as well was the Queen's Jubilee. I'm trying to remember which number, but both those events, the royal wedding and the Jubilee, were pretty huge. I think there was a bank holiday for one of them, a day off work.
Right.
I was in London for both of them, and it was massive crowds. I think many of our listeners, you've probably seen the pictures of Buckingham Palace, and you've seen the road leading there, and then there's St. James's Park is this big park in front of Buckingham Palace.
Right.
You couldn't even get into that area by the time I got there, which was well before everything started, but they were already completely filled with people. You couldn't get there. Many of the major stations in the middle of the area were just closed. The police had closed them because there were too many people. They didn't, trains coming there didn't open their doors because they didn't want more, people would have gotten crushed and killed if you keep sending people into those areas. It was that packed. You had street parties organized. I think it was actually for the Jubilee that the village that I lived in at the time, we had this big street party, and I think it's the only one I've ever remember happening. But they're happening all over the place, and there were big celebrations. The roads were closed. There was a big bonfire party in the evening. There were different competitions. My wife won second prize in the village baking competition.
Nice. So you were at the street party.
Yeah.
Wow. This is new revelation. Our very own Richard Palmer at a street party. That was for the royal wedding in 2000.
I think that was the Jubilee, actually. One was. But I was in London for both. But they were both big, high-profile royal events. And even the supermarkets with the whole feeling surrounding both of those was very different to the lead up to this wedding.
Yeah. Now, of course, it's obvious that Prince Harry is one further step removed from the throne. But besides that, why so little interest after, what would that be, 7 years?
Mm-hmm. It's a really good question. I think part of it is also who they're marrying. I think Kate Middleton was now the Duchess of Cambridge. She was very popular.
Right.
And there was, almost a fairy tale element to that, the kind of the commoner that grows up and marries the next in line to the throne. Whereas Meghan Markle doesn't have the same popularity, I don't think, over here.
Mm-hmm.
She's perished the thought an American. And so even though they could, I think we both saw an article this morning talking about, there might be some interest in America because of that.
Right.
Over here, I think that takes some of the sheen off it. And then just even, her history, her background means a lot of the type of people that get excited about the monarchy, which tend to be people that are conservative, that kind of have a close allegiance to Britain's historic values. Well, when you have a member of those kind of people are not going to get so excited about the royal family marrying, somebody who's been divorced before and all of this background. So the people that would normally be organizing the street parties, I think, are the ones that are maybe turned off by some elements of this.
Yeah, I mean, there's, as you mentioned, the one story about the wedding craze in America. It's obviously it's going to get some publicity here and in America, but there's no question that the interest level is considerably less than it was in 2011. This independent story, it says here, news of the fall in street party numbers came as a YouGov poll suggested that 66% of British people were not interested in the royal wedding. 66%. And then it quotes this Graham Smith of Republic. He's an anti-monarchist. And he's quoted in this piece as saying, "We're told this weekend's wedding is a national celebration. Clearly, that's not true," he says. "The royals are running out of fresh ideas and big PR opportunities. Now the real debate about this rotten institution must be." he says, "We're not a nation of Republicans yet, but we've stopped being a nation of royalists." So he's very much against the monarchy. But still, he brings up some compelling points in that, you know, for those that would say it's just sweeping across the nation, it's not. And there's quite a few people that are very much against it and would like to see the monarchy dissolved.
And I think those points he made, I mean, he is spot on in that, you know, yeah, I brought out maybe some things that are particular to this particular wedding. But the point that he made about just excitement in the royal family overall, I think that's definitely true. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, there might be some aspects of this that people are less excited about. But, yeah, I think they're less excited about the monarchy overall. I remember after the royal wedding, you know, people were saying, well, this is the biggest event until Harry gets married.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, obviously, he wasn't dating back then, or this particular individual, but there was still like this sense of, OK, we're going to do this again because Prince Harry's going to be getting married pretty soon. And everyone's going to be really excited about that. But the fact that there hasn't been that same excitement, I think, shows that the excitement in the monarchy itself has decreased since 2011.
Right. Yeah, and I think the most fascinating aspect of this story, these two weddings, is really what God's work, God's church, has been saying. We pulled up an article from 2011. This was my father writing about the royal wedding then, saying that 2 billion people watched it. It got an avalanche of news coverage. And he says, this is from 2011, that there was one main reason why the audience was so large. And when we understand it, it will fill our lives with hope and joy. Everyone knows that the wedding revolved around a royal throne. Very few, however, understand that this throne, the royal family to which Prince William belongs, was prophesied in your Bible to be here in this end time. And then from there, he takes the readers into a number of prophecies about David's throne, Luke chapter 1, Isaiah 9, and so on. And then he concludes the article from 2011 saying that, why was the wedding of Prince William and Catherine Middleton so important? Because through that magnificent and miracle-filled wedding, the world was given breathtaking insight into David's throne and the future kingdom of God. Now, you fast forward to what my father wrote through last year, particularly the September issue of the Trumpet magazine, where he talked about the fall of the British royal family. And he went through in that article just how bad of a year it's been for the British monarchy, and you can go through 2017 and just see one, not just the monarchy, but even the terrorist attacks on British soil. And my father said in that piece from September, it seems the royal family has followed a similar course as the UK, that is. In 1952, when Elizabeth took the throne, the British Empire was beginning its descent from world power. She has witnessed it shrink from empire to commonwealth to a less and less relevant second-rate power. Some commentaries say this year may mark the beginning of the end for the monarchy. And so really, I mean, we can speculate on what all of the factors are as to why there's so little interest, or at least comparatively why there's so little interest. But really, it has more to do with this than anything else, in that you see, again, the beginning of the end of this monarchy. My father in that piece, by the way, talks about how that, and he quotes from The Spectator and some other sources here in the UK about how that it's just turned into a high-profile reality show, basically, with celebrity this, celebrity that, and this is what it's turned into. And it's no wonder that people in this, and you know, in one sense you think, well, it's celebrity and people would be interested in because it's a celebrity crazed culture. But in fact, people are losing interest in what was once a very royal institution that really did have that strong connection to the throne of David. Well, together with what my father wrote in 2017, He also came out in that same year with dramatic revelation about the throne of David. And as it happens, I mentioned at the start of the show our very latest booklet, How to Pray. That's now posted at the trumpet.com website, together with this other brand new booklet, The New Throne of David, essential reading as you head into this royal wedding weekend. It would be a good time to read my father's latest, The New Throne of David. The quip inside the front cover says, "A dramatic change in how God is handling this throne shows how soon Jesus Christ himself will be sitting on it." So go to thetrumpet.com if you haven't already to look at the PDF or request that new booklet when it's printed here in the next few weeks. We want to thank Richard Palmer for joining us in the studio today. At the end of the week, you can listen to him later today on the Trumpet Hour with your host, Joel Hilliker. You're listening to Stephen Fleury, and this is the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. If you'd like to email the program, you can send comments to td@kpcg.fm. Thank you for joining us today. Thank you for joining us this week, and we'll see you next week.